some of the most powerful people in New York City, and Brian Kilmeade. Remember, Brian, I told you? Brian and I started doing stand-up together, so we're friends, hopefully. You know, because this room is, I'm glad you guys have a sense of humor about this, because this room is undeniably impressive. It really is. The prestige, the wealth, the allegations. I mean, wow. And don't feel bad if you don't have any allegations yet, okay? Which reminds me, Letitia James is here. She had a great year. She's just back there watching all of you. She's watching. By the way, can I point out that this is a very nimble thing that I'm trying to do, Brian? Because if I am too critical of Vice President Harris, I will lose friendships and mess up my career. And if I am too critical of President Trump, I will lose friendships and improve my career. You know what I mean? We have an amazing, by the way, RFK Jr. is here. Welcome, sir. RFK Jr. He, of course, is going to make America, he's part of the MAGA, Make America Healthy Again, right? I don't know if he's seen what Donald Trump eats, but Donald Trump eats like, well, me and the Cardinal, okay? And anyway, now the prompter guy, I went off book a little bit here. So anyway, I'd like to also welcome Mayor Adams, brought to you by Turkish Airlines. I was told to say that. It's a sponsorship deal, people. You know, we have a lot of formers on the dais tonight, all right? Former mayors, former governors, former respected journalists. Is there any other kind, really? Now, I understand some people may have an issue with a journalist appearing on a dais hobnobbing with the rich and powerful. It would appear like a clear conflict of interest, and that's because it absolutely is. Look, the days of Walter Cronkite are gone. Most journalists have their own TikTok. You know, President Trump regularly appears on a show called Fox and Friends. That's not a mistake. He's their best friend. Former Mayor Bloomberg is here. Mayor Bloomberg, you're going to close that deal on the bringing us to 10 million? Can you just... Not an agreement, sir. Okay. Now, by the way, there are rumors that Mayor Bloomberg is planning to run for mayor. I don't know if that's true. Quick question, Mayor Bloomberg. When you buy an election, do you put it on a credit card so you can get the points? Because that's what I would do. I already did the RFK joke, so. The one thing that I was going to say is that I feel like Donald Trump, Make America Healthy Again, I feel like Donald Trump would probably be less loyal to RFK than he would be to KFC. Do you know what I mean? It's like, I think the rank of Colonel Sanders. Some of these I wrote during lunch. Woody Johnson is here tonight, owner of the New York Jets, heir to the Johnson & Johnson pharmaceutical fortune. You know, in divisive times, sir, You are a shining example, okay? If the head of Johnson & Johnson can sign an unvaxxed quarterback, maybe there is hope for this country. All right? Not only is Woody Johnson here, Robert Kraft, owner of the New England Patriots, is here.
Welcome.
By the way, as we know, they are bitter rivals on the football field. But here tonight, they're here for the same reason. Billionaires supporting Trump. It's really beautiful. We are 19 days from the election. This presidential election, it's been different, right? I mean, it's crazy because there's no Russian interference, no Facebook. It's crazy. It's being left up to American voters and four billionaires. The Cardinal wrote that joke. There is one group that baffles me, and I think it baffles most everyone in this country, and I'm talking about the undecided voter. Are you kidding me? I mean, are you kidding me? You don't know who you're voting for? You don't see a difference between Kamala Harris and Donald Trump. Like, nobody has ever thought, wait, is that a Trump quote or a Harris quote? The media has begun discussing the phenomena of secret Trump voters. I don't know if you've heard about this. People who publicly say they would never vote for Trump, but then when they go in the voting booth, they do. It's a small group. They're called the Biden family. You know, I think we'd all agree that, you know, we live in divided times, and whoever is elected in November, I hope they establish an initiative to heal the divide that exists in this country. And I have a great name for this. It could be called Project 2025. It has a nice, Chuck, do you like it? Okay. Our first presentation tonight will be by Vice President Kamala Harris, okay? You have to admit, the Democrats have done an amazing job rebranding Vice President Harris, right? The term joyful warrior was used so many times at the Democratic convention, I felt like I was at a yoga retreat. Let's start off in a joyful warrior pose. And then go straight into downward facing Doug Emhoff. Good. Now laugh uncontrollably. Remember to breathe. Vice President Harris's trajectory has been astounding. In just the course of a couple months, she went from mediocre vice president to everyone's mamala. This is, of course, a historic race for many reasons, right? If Vice President Harris wins this election, not only would she be the first female president, a black woman would occupy the White House, a former Trump residence. Obviously, you wouldn't be renting to her. I mean, that would never happen anyway. Maybe if Doug did the signing. All right. That one didn't work. Yeah, this has been an interesting presidential campaign. The Democrats have been telling us Trump's re-election is a threat to democracy. In fact, they were so concerned of this threat, they staged a coup, ousted their democratically elected incumbent, and installed Kamala Harris. In other words, all her dreams have come true. Really? It really makes you consider the power of prayer, right, Cardinal? Sometimes prayers take 3.5 years and a George Clooney op-ed. Yeah. I don't know who's angry, but I don't care. But Vice President Harris did have a scheduling conflict, but was generous enough to send us this video. Let's take a look.
Your Eminence and distinguished guests, the Al Smith dinner provides a rare opportunity to set aside partisanship.
Cool. Oh, sorry.
Hey, what's going on? Who was that?
Oh, sorry, Mary Catherine Gallagher. Mary Catherine Gallagher, it's so nice to meet you.
Very nice to meet you, Mary Catherine. Right now I'm trying to record my speech for tonight's dinner.
Oh, yeah, I know. I just want to say that I'm Catholic, and tonight is one of the biggest dinners next to the Last Supper.
It is a very important dinner, and it's an important tradition that I'm so proud to be a part of.
Sometimes when I get nervous, I stick my fingers under my arms, and I simulate them like that. But that's gross.
So tell me something. I'm giving a speech. Do you have some thoughts about what I might say tonight?
My feelings about what you should say tonight would be best expressed in a monologue from one of my favorite made-for-TV series.
Okay, let's hear it.
Don't you see, man? We need a woman to represent us. A woman brings more heart, more compassion. And think how smart she must be to become a top contender in a field dominated by men. It's time for a woman, bro. And with this woman, we can fly.
What series was that from?
Oh, that's from House of Dragons, now streaming on HBO Max.
Is there anything that you think that maybe I shouldn't bring up tonight?
Well, don't lie. Thou shalt not bear false witness to thy neighbor.
Indeed, especially thy neighbor's election results.
Just so you know, there will be a fact checker there tonight.
Oh, that's great. Who?
Jesus. And maybe don't say anything negative about Catholics.
I would never do that, no matter where I was. That would be like criticizing Detroit in Detroit.
Does it bother you that Trump guy insults you all the time? Because it really bothers my friends and me.
Oh, Mary Catherine, it's very important to always remember you should never let anyone tell you who you are. You tell them who you are.
Haters gonna hate. Shake it off.
Shake it off. Good for you, Mary Catherine.
Oh, yeah, okay. And also remember one more thing. Don't worry if you make a mistake, because Catholic people are very forgiving. Yeah, and also one last thing I want to tell you. Don't forget to say superstar.
Thank you, Mary Catherine.
Thank you, Mamala.
Thank you. Your Eminence and distinguished guest, the Al Smith dinner provides a rare opportunity to set aside partisanship and come together to do some good by supporting the tremendous charitable work of the Catholic Church. The Church cares for the sick and feeds the hungry, supports families with housing and education, and in times of disaster, provides not only essential supplies, but also, and so importantly, a sense of hope. The Gospel of Luke tells us that faith has the power to shine a light on those living in darkness and to guide our feet in the path of peace. In the spirit of tonight's dinner, let us recommit to reaching across divides to seek understanding and common ground. And in honor of the great Al Smith, let us fight to build a better future with faith in God, our country, and in each other. Thank you. May God bless you, and may God bless the United States of America.
I don't even know what that noise you're making is. Someone goes, ah. I don't know. As I watched that, I couldn't help but think of now I know how my kids felt when I FaceTimed into a piano recital they were at.
Tradition holds that I'm supposed to tell a few self-deprecating jokes this evening. So here it goes. Nope. I've got nothing. There's nothing to say. I guess I just don't see the point of taking shots at myself when other people have been shooting at me for a hell of a long time and they shoot at me. But I know this isn't my normal crowd tonight, because it just isn't. It's not my normal crowd. Believe me, my normal crowd is younger, has a lot more energy. But you have certain advantages too, like cash, lots of cash. But many of you are Manhattan liberals from the media and the Democrat Party. I always say the Democrat, you know, Chuck doesn't like that. He likes Democratic. And it sounds much more beautiful, the Democratic Party. I always say the Democrat Party because it sounds worse. And it's true. He likes Democratic. Why don't they just change the name? This way, you know, it is Democrat. But I must say I was shocked when I heard that Kamala was skipping the Al Smith dinner. I'd really hoped that she would come because we can't get enough of hearing her beautiful laugh. She laughs like crazy. We would recognize it any place in this room, and all polls are indicating I'm leading big with the Catholic vote, as I should be. But I don't think Kamala has given up yet. She hasn't. Instead of attending tonight, she's in Michigan receiving communion from Gretchen Whitmer. That's not a pretty sight. But Catholics, please don't be too insulted by Kamala's absence. If the Democrats, he says, thank you very much, I appreciate it. If Democrats really wanted to have someone not be with us this evening, they would have just sent Joe Biden. You know, he's having second thoughts, you know that, right? He wants to come back. If she does any worse in the polls, they're going to bring him back again, I think. Chuck, he's going to do it. He's the one that got him out. That's the guy. Much more so than Crazy Nancy, I will tell you. Because I know him. He did it. Joe has almost disappeared from view. The only way he could be seen less is if he had a show on CNN. They had nothing. They've got nothing. Fake news, right? Fake. Someone in the White House who can barely talk, barely put together two coherent sentences, who seems to have mental faculties of a child, it's sad. Is a person that has nothing going, no intelligence whatsoever, but enough about Kamala Harris. Let's get on to something else. I know Kamala's word because she spends a lot of time complaining. I won't agree to another debate. But the truth is, I've debated twice this year, once against Joe Biden and once against David Muir of ABC. It's been a long tradition for both Democrat and Republican candidates for president of the United States to attend this dinner. Always, it's a rule. You got to go to the dinner. You got to do it. Otherwise, bad things are going to happen to you from up there. You can't do what I just saw on that screen. But my opponent feels like she does not have to be here, which is deeply disrespectful. I've never liked people that I was competing against. When you do, a lot of bad things happen. And we are doing well. By the way, the votes are starting to come in. You got to get out and vote. And Catholics, you got to vote for me. Just remember. You better remember I'm here. And she's not. I could have done that, too. But you do something that's incredible, that Catholic Church, you're helping the poor, educating children, and supporting the vulnerable. But if you really wanted Vice President Harris to accept your invitation, I guess you should have told her the funds were going to bail out the looters and rioters in Minneapolis, and she would have been here guaranteed. She would have been here. Guaranteed. The last Democrat not to attend this important event was Walter Mondale. And it did not go very well for him. He lost 49 states and he won one, Minnesota. So I said, there's no way I'm missing it. Actually, it was not easy for me to get here tonight. Cardinal, I wasn't going to miss this thing. You know, matter, I didn't care. I wasn't going to miss it. But that's true. Walter Mondale, 49-1. He was expected to do well. And it didn't work out. It shows you there is a God. I mean, for those people that are questioning it. I understand the real reason that she's not here is she's hunting with her running mate, spending a lot of time hunting. In any event, it's a weird, 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 weird. You know the word weird. They call me weird. They call JD weird. We're very solid people. This guy is calling us weird, but this was weird that the Democrat candidate is not here and with us tonight. Senator Schumer, good. I supported him. I was, oh, I don't know. I don't know. He used to say that's true, and now I'm not sure he would. But I gave him his first check from an office in Beach Haven, and I was very proud of it. I don't know about lately. Chuck Schumer is here looking very glum. Doesn't he look glum? He looks glum. But look on the bright side, Chuck, considering how woke your party has become. If Kamala loses, you still have a chance to become the first woman president. And I actually said, do you mind if I do that? He said, no, you got to do what you got to do. He's a pro. He's a professional. No, he's a good man, actually. I hate to say it. Don't ever use it against me, please. I'll say this dinner was really setting me back when I say that, but I've known him a long time. There's a group called White Dudes for Harris. Have you seen this? White Dudes for Harris. Anybody know? Are some of you here? White Dudes for Harris. Doesn't sound like it. But I'm not worried about them at all because their wives and their wives' lovers are all voting for me. I didn't like Biden very much, and now I like him quite a bit. You know, it's... And now I say that she's much worse than him. He was a much better candidate than her, actually. And when we hopefully win, dispose of her, I like her a lot. But right now, I can't stand her. It's true. I can't stand her. A lot of people don't like it. The only piece of advice I would have for her in the event that she wins would be not to let her husband, Doug, anywhere near the nannies. Just keep them away. That's a nasty one. That's nasty. I told these idiots that gave me this stuff, that's too tough. Oh, I did. You know, they told me the last time I did this, I was running against Crooked Hillary. And, I mean Hillary. No, I was running against Crooked Hillary and I did it. And I thought it was a roast. So I was told it's a roast. And I had the meanest guy you've ever seen write stuff up. And man, was the room angry. Even the cardinal remembers. I went overboard, don't you agree, cardinal? It was like terrible. And I knew I was in trouble around midway through because, you know, people had not, even my own side was angry at me. They were saying, it's too much. But I did it anyway. I didn't give it any. I'd like to thank our MC this evening, Jim Gaffigan. Most recently, Jim has been playing Tim Walz on Saturday Night Live. And that'll be a very short gig, I hope, Jim. But it was fun while it lasted, wasn't it? Let's see how that lasts, right? It better be quick. We don't want him, and you know, I'm not going to say anymore. But unfortunately, Governor Walz isn't here himself, but don't worry, he'll say that he was. He's going to say he was. I used to think the Democrats were crazy for saying that men have periods, but then I met Tim Walz. The stupid show, The View, is so bad now that the other day I was watching it and thinking to myself, you know what? They really need to bring Rosie O'Donnell back. That show is bad. Those people are bad. I know every one of them, and they are bad news, I want to tell you.
This Alfred Smith dinner last night at the Catholic fundraiser that they were having. And, you know, it seems like one of Trump's biggest campaign's issue is this show. Watch this.
The stupid show, The View, is so bad now that the other day I was watching it and thinking to myself, you know what? They really need to bring Rosie O'Donnell back. That show is bad. Those people are bad. I know every one of them, and they are bad news, I want to tell you. And it doesn't do very well either. I always like to say, you know, ratings are very important. When they don't do well, it doesn't do very well.
Anyway, I think he's met He's met all of us except Sonny.
Hell no.
In fact, she's the only.
He has
wait
never
a minute.
Met me.
No.
I don't know what the hell you're reading, but I gotta tell you, I've lived 52 years. I've lived 44 years in this country. I have never shaken that man's hand. I've never given him a kiss. I've never watched his show. I've never bought any of his crappy products, and I never voted for him.
No.
But wait a second. She's the only prosecutor he has ever met.
Okay, that was worth it.
That's probably true.
More specific. Although the interesting thing is, I have seen him and he has seen me, so we have met because I covered his trial.
He watches our show. He's seen all of us. Okay. Also, I would just like to note we are number one in daytime over the last 4 years, so the ratings are fine. But this also cracked me up because after he came after you recently, he apparently came after me on a podcast and said he didn't know me, he never met me, despite that I worked for him. Yeah. And then now he's saying he knows me, which gets back to my point. I think he's slowing down. I really
think he's losing it.
And he doesn't know he's never actually met these
three. You think he's failing a little bit?
He's losing it. But you know what? Isn't it in such an enjoyable thing to live rent-free in his head?
Yeah.
I mean, we live rent-free in this man's head.
It's a scary place to be.
I enjoy it. I enjoy it. And I enjoy that he has admitted now at least 3 to 4 times that he watches the show.
Well,
thank you. Thank you. Thank you, Donald. Hi.
I will tell you, the part I loved about yesterday was Kamala Harris at that rally in Wisconsin.
Show the clip.
Yeah, so we have a clip of Kamala disposing with hecklers at one of the rallies in Wisconsin yesterday.
They would undo the protections of Roe v. Wade, and they did as he intended. Oh, you guys are at the wrong rally. You meant to go to the smaller one down the street.
It is so perfect. See, people are seeing the real Kamala now because we both know her. We've spent private time with her. She's funny. She's witty. She's got the gift of spontaneous wit. Yeah, yeah. And that but is that, what you
well,
just
remember
saw.
Last week, Donald Trump said in a California rally to a heckler, she should, quote, get the hell knocked out of her. So that's right. The difference between the candidates you're dealing with is humor that drops the mic versus literally violence
and
towards a female.
And any time she can make a reference to size.
Crowd size.
It's a good thing.
But this is why she should have gone to the dinner last
night.
She was working in a swing state. She did 3 rallies yesterday.
Right, so she was in Green Bay, La Crosse, and Milwaukee, where the voters are. Yeah. New York.
Mark Cuban.
You all, you know what, in New York, you all think the world revolves around New York. It doesn't.
Oh, my God.
You have the floor, Joy.
Mira qué cosa, eso no es todo para hacer nada.
We're entering the final stretch here, and what may be, people think it might be, who knows? Honestly, the most amazing thing is nobody knows if it will be the closest presidential race of the century. It is deeply personal, though. Harris unleashing a new line of attack in the final days, questioning Trump's low energy.
I've been hearing reports that his team, at least, is saying he's suffering from exhaustion. And that's apparently the excuse for why he's not doing interviews. And, of course, he's not doing the CNN town hall. He refuses to do another debate. And, you know, look, being president of the United States is probably one of the hardest jobs in the world. And so we really do need to ask if he's exhausted being on the campaign trail. Is he fit to do the job?
All right, that comment got under the former president's skin. He has responded not once but twice.
I've gone 48 days now without a rest, and I've got that loser who doesn't have the energy of a rabbit. Tell me when you've seen me take even a little bit of a rest. Not only am I not, I'm not even tired. I'm really exhilarated. You know why? We're killing her in the polls. We'll go through it pretty quick, Gal, and then I'm going over to make a little speech in front of 10,000 people. You think this is an easy life I have, right? I go from here. I say, am I finished? They say, no, sir, you have one more speech. Oh, good. Where is it?
Says he's exhilarated. So, meanwhile, Vice President Kamala Harris tonight addressing a question that continually comes up. That is, what would she have done differently than Joe Biden?
I mean, to be very candid with you, you, even including Mike Pence, vice presidents are not critical of their presidents. I think that really actually, in terms of the tradition of it and also just going forward, it does not make for a productive and important relationship.
Jane, you heard that back and forth between Harris and Trump on the energy issue. Politico reported that he canceled interviews because of exhaustion. So I just wanted to play a little bit more of his reaction to Harris's comments about that. Here he is.
What event did I cancel? I haven't canceled. She doesn't go to any events. She's a loser. She doesn't go to any events. She didn't even show up for the Catholics last night at the hotel. It was insulted. All they are is sound bites. So today I was at Fox and Friends at 7 in the morning. I then went to two different other appearances. I then made about 15 phone calls.
And you know, to be fair, he is doing a lot, right? He did go to the Al Smith dinner in New York last night. We were able to see him for the entire time that others were speaking. He was fully engaged. Harris sent that recorded video that we saw there. He did do that interview this morning, a roundtable this evening, a rally tonight. Is that not enough?
Well, I think given the fact that he fell asleep during an event today and the fact that his Fox and Friends interview featured... how can I put this? Some nonsensical statements. Now, granted, the thing with Donald Trump is that, like, this is what he's been like for a long time. But I will say that the energy issue, it's clear that it is annoying him. It is clear that Harris bringing that up has annoyed him as he keeps bringing it up. And it's interesting because there are specific things you can do to annoy him. One, accuse him of being low energy. And two, do something on Fox that he doesn't like. And this is, you know, this is now twice that this has taken place. So I do think it's clearly an issue for him, or else he wouldn't keep bringing it up.
Well, it is under his skin, Aaron. Clearly, I mean, he's angered by it, which may be exactly why she's you know, sort of picking at that scab.
Well, in the land of reality, the dog won't hunt that Donald Trump doesn't have energy, right? I mean, what has he done? 59 interviews to Kamala Harris's 26 since she was announced. He's more than doubled her at this point. And he's doing multiple events a day. But that's what both candidates should be doing. The exception to the rule shouldn't be that there might be a scheduling snafu and that Trump's team might be trying to put things on the calendar that don't firm up because of other things on the schedule. It's a presidential campaign. Everybody should be out there. They should be doing three rallies a day. You should be doing multiple roundtable events. You should be doing radio interviews and local television poll asides the entire time. Both candidates should do it. And I would argue, and I think the facts would bear out, Donald Trump is doing a lot more of all of that than Kamala Harris is. And because she waited so long to try and engage voters and engage the media and talk through different outlets, that's why she's having to try to make up ground now, because she is slipping in the polls.
Now, Mark, she did do that interview with Fox this week. That I know that, you know, Trump supporters found that, say, oh, she didn't do well. Her supporters felt she walked into the lion's den and she fought back and she's on fire. And, you know, that's how they saw it very differently. But you know, everybody noticed that, including him. He noticed it. He brought it up at the Al Smith dinner last night that she had done that interview. Does it bother him that she did that? I mean, because there's got to be a part of him that said, okay, the lion's den take on that, he would see it the same way.
I think he's happier with her responses that they're going to use in future ads. I think Aaron is right. What really is the thing that bothers him, or what you've mentioned that really bothers him, is the fact that he's being attacked for his energy levels in the campaign trail. I ran the numbers. Since October 1st, the beginning of the month, in 18 days, he's done 28 events in 26 cities spread across 12 states. And when Kamala Harris says that he's hiding from the public and the press, that just drives him crazy. And she knows what she's doing, and so far it does seem to be working. He's swinging at every pitch.
Right. I mean, that's the thing. Some of this is just about getting under someone's skin. So, Karen, I want to ask you about one of those many appearances that Trump did. Today was an interview that aired today with the former professional wrestler and media personality Tyrus, and I wanted to play one exchange that everyone is talking about. Here it is.
We need to see that fathers are capable of great things, because we've dealt with it, especially in the last 3.5 years,
right,
a complete dismemberment of what it is to be a man. We're under attack for everything.
We are. Well, actually, manhood is under attack.
Yeah.
I see things that are so beautiful, and the next day I see them knocking the hell out of somebody for doing something that a day before. I said, what a wonderful thing. No, we have to get back a little bit more.
Okay, Karen, I'll be honest. I don't really know what he was saying after the core point there. But he said manhood is under attack. Now, to be fair, that was in response to somebody who said a dismemberment of what it is to be a man, which let's just not take literally. But when he says manhood is under attack, is that effective with a certain group of voters? I mean, you know, you can say, okay, well, I didn't know Maxim made endorsements, the magazine, but they did come out and endorse Trump today.
Yeah, look, he believes that, and we saw this, you know, all the way back to 2016 when he would sort of, and frankly, years ago in the 80s, right, in New York, that was part of his swagger, right, that he was this kind of playboy. And that's kind of part of his definition of manhood. And that is something he has put forward time and time again. It's what that infamous, you know, you can grab him by the you know what was all about. At the same time, I think men are a lot smarter, most men, than Donald Trump. I should say the majority of American men. I think they're smart enough to know that he's a huckster and he's been trying to, you know, he's selling a shtick. They can either buy it or not. I think they're smart enough to know that the lives of their daughters and their sisters and their mothers, the women in their lives, are in danger by some of the, you know, by what Donald Trump would do. And I think they're smart enough to recognize that he is actually not going to be good for the bottom line, given that he's so into tariffs, which will increase inflation.
So, Mark, when Trump says, well, actually, manhood is under attack, you know, there are times that he does say things for hyperbole's sake or whatever, but it would actually seem this is one of those ones he actually means. I don't know. Is that what you understand it to be?
Yeah, that's a general belief in Republican and conservative circles. And that's a dividing line that we're seeing in this campaign, where there was a recent article in The Washington Post that accused the Trump campaign of being fueled by too much toxic masculinity. And the Trump campaign read that as essentially an attack on Trump for just standing up for men. This is one of these kind of men are from Mars and women are from Venus sort of campaigns that we're looking at.
Thanks for listening. And don't forget to vote.
Hi, this is God. Whenever I'm in Pittsburgh, which is always because I'm omnipresent, I listen to every radio station at the same time, including WRCT.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, you don't hear the phrase free market capitalism so much anymore, but the idea still tacitly undergirds much of what you do hear about why products and services are the way they are. We all know about corruption and cronyism, but we still accept that the company that wins, that corners the market, does so because people simply prefer what they sell. The anti-monopoly ruling against Google challenges that idea of how things work. We'll hear about it from Lee Heppner, senior legal counsel at the American Economic Liberties Project. Also on the show, a recent news report offered the familiar construction that the attacks of September 11th, 2001 plunged the U.S. into decades of war. Of course, that's not right. Choices were made, unpopular choices, about how to respond to the attacks. Choices were made to not bring assailants to trial for the crime, but instead to detain people without charge and hold them indefinitely in a prison designed to be outside U.S. law. None of it was inevitable. Now the defense secretary has stepped in to overturn plea agreements that, while they wouldn't have closed Guantanamo, would have brought some measure of closure to the cases against the alleged directors of the September 11th attacks. We'll get an update from Shaina Kadudal, senior managing attorney at the Center for Constitutional Rights. That's coming up, but first a quick look back at some recent press. With the presidential contest in full swing, the Sinclair Broadcast Group appears to be ramping up its right-wing propaganda again. While millions of Americans are subjected to the TV network's electioneering, few know it. That's because, as Pete Tucker details for Fair.org, Sinclair blends into the woodwork. So when you turn on your local news, you may well be watching a Sinclair station, even though on your screen it appears labeled as a major network, like CBS, NBC, or Fox. Millions of people tell pollsters they no longer trust the news media, but there's an exception. At least 6 years ago or so, 76% of Americans said they still trust their local news stations, more than the percentage professing to trust their family or friends, according to The New Yorker. Sinclair is smart enough to leave its affiliates alone long enough for them to develop a rapport with their audience. As former New York Times public editor Margaret Sullivan put it, the fact that it looks normal most of the time is part of the problem. What Sinclair is cynically doing is trading on the trust that develops among local news people and their local audience. By hijacking this relationship, Sinclair can sneak its propaganda into millions of homes, including in presidential swing states where the network owns more stations than any other. How do they do it? By requiring affiliates to air the right-wing stories it sends them. But because these segments are introduced or delivered by trusted local hosts, they gain credibility. Usually it goes undetected, but in 2018, Sinclair pushed its luck by requiring anchors around the country to read from the identical Trumpian anti-media script, a video compilation of dozens, if not hundreds, of Sinclair anchors voicing the same commentary went viral. Nevertheless, Tucker explains, Sinclair carries on largely under the radar, quietly gobbling up stations, mainly in cheaper markets. We're forever expanding, like the universe, said longtime leader David Smith, under whose watch the network has become the second largest in the country. Of the 294 TV stations that Sinclair owns or operates, at least 70 of them air the network's in-house national evening news broadcast. In January, Eugene Ramirez, who had anchored that broadcast for a year and a half, resigned. His public explanation was that every night he was given a list of four stories produced out of Sinclair's headquarters. From these, he had to select at least three to air. Often these stories were little more than write-ups of press releases from right-wing politicians and groups, like one from July whose headline read, "Trump PAC launches new ad hitting Democrats on border. Joe Biden does nothing." Sinclair frequently booked far-right guests to appear on Ramirez's broadcast, and he was instructed not to interrupt them, according to reporting by Popular Information. Ramirez was told that many Sinclair affiliates were not in big cities, and the content of the broadcast had to reflect the sensitivities of those viewers. Needless to say, progressive guests rarely, if ever, appeared. Popular Information also found that Sinclair requires around 200 of its affiliates to air its Question of the Day, which has included such gems as, "Do you think former House Speaker Pelosi deserves some of the blame for the January 6th riot?" Other questions were less obviously biased, but still betrayed tenets of independent journalism. As Tucker writes, it's one thing when a blowhard on Fox News asks, "Are you concerned violent criminals are crossing the border?" But it's quite another when the same question is asked by a familiar and trusted local anchor. And then remember that it's not just one local anchor, but a small army of them in communities across the country every day. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group Fair. Google is a monopolist, and it has acted as one to maintain its monopoly. So ruled District Court Judge Ahmed Mehta in United States versus Google, being called a landmark antitrust case that will affect not just Google, but potentially all tech giants in the current landscape. The point was Google pays billions every year to companies like Apple and Samsung that distribute search engines to ensure that it's the only search engine anyone would see, by making sure it's the preset default on devices. If your supermarket only had one brand of milk on the shelf, even if it had some others in the back, you would recognize that as unfair. But for many of us, the internet is still a mystery miracle, and we're not used to bringing the same sorts of questions to bear. If it did nothing else, this ruling changes that. So what happened? Lee Heppner is an antitrust lawyer and senior legal counsel for the American Economic Liberties Project. He joins us now by phone. Welcome to Counterspin, Lee Heppner.
Thanks so much for having me.
The Sherman Antitrust Act sounds like a history lesson. It's from 1890, but it's living, meaningful law. How or why exactly did the judge determine that Google was in violation of it?
You said it right there. This is a law that dates back to the 19th century. It used to be used against railroad barons, has now been applied to this new tech industry. It's really proof of the durability of one of the foundational laws for ensuring fair markets and competition across our economy. And Google is ripe for being addressed by this law. The judge found that Google was essentially without competition in the market for search engines. And truth be told, I mean, 80% of overall searches are conducted via Google on mobile devices. That's 95%. And Google is able to profit extraordinarily off of not having competition and by blocking out rivals who threaten to create new and innovative products that actually benefit consumers and move this technology forward. So that was really at the crux of the judge's decision in this case.
So it isn't just that Google is the default search engine, it's that they are doing things, including paying money, to maintain that and to prevent other companies from being that.
That's exactly right. And the judge really eloquently, in his opinion, describes how Google maintains its power through that circular system. It pays for exclusive agreements across Apple, Samsung, Mozilla, other device manufacturers. And by virtue of those exclusive agreements, it achieves scale that it then sells to advertisers for extraordinary revenue. And then it reinvests that revenue back at the beginning in securing those exclusive agreements. So you really see how this is a self-reinforcing monopoly that Google has been able to maintain through anti-competitive conduct.
Well, and we know it's not by accident, if anyone were to believe that. There are internal messages I just read in a piece by Matt Stoller where Google is saying inertia is the path of least resistance. They know what they're doing.
Oh, absolutely. It's a clear monopoly strategy. And just to be clear, those are the communications that we were able to see. Google was also criticized by this judge for deleting untold number of records that were relevant to the litigation. And that was a big part of this case, too. What Google didn't say, because they were training employees to move communications to secret servers that auto-deleted chats. So even in the absence of a smoking gun, there was a very clear sense that Google was intentionally perpetuating an illegal scheme to maintain its market power.
Well, it's worth noting that this isn't just kind of a meta issue or inconsequential. There is an impact of the quality of searches. You know, not everyone's just looking for Thai restaurant near me. It matters if searches are not the best that they could be, yeah?
Yeah, we've all heard stories about Google search becoming worse over time. It's kind of harder to find that thing that you were looking for because they're not necessarily investing in the rank of search results, or they're prioritizing paid ads that look like organic search results. So Google has maintained its monopoly position, not necessarily by having a superior product, but by blocking out rivals. And that's just a core characteristic of monopolies that is as old as time, and we see across a lot of industries.
Well, yeah, I was just going to say Google is not being punished for building a better mousetrap. And news media, I think, play a role here for the anthropomorphizing of especially tech companies as scrappy, as game changers. They're not AT&T. We've sort of been trained to think these guys, and they are guys, break the rules, but on behalf of all of us. And that's not what's happening here.
Well, sure, and it's just a radically different industry than it was, say, in the early 2000s after we broke up the last big monopoly, Microsoft. That was a quarter century ago since the last decision that on a case brought by the government against a big monopoly. And then we were seeing that kind of scrappy innovation. Google was a startup at that point. And I think right there really lends to the potential of this case and of this decision to unlock a new era of innovation where small tech innovators are able to have a chance at entering the market and creating something new and cool that maybe we can't imagine today, but wouldn't be possible without breaking up Google's hold on this industry.
Well, I was going to ask you, what do you think happens now? We can't necessarily predict it, but in terms of the case, what do you think will happen as we look to the remedy stage of things?
Just to be clear, this is a case that was bifurcated. We just concluded the liability phase, and now the judge has to decide what to do about it. Mm-hmm. And what's good about this stage is that the court has broad latitude and must be deferential to the government's request for remedies after that really difficult finding of liability. And there's a lot of tools on the table. Certainly, we can expect an end to some of the exclusive agreements that have tied up this market for Google. But we also might see structural remedies that deprive Google of some of its ill-gotten gains and divest certain business lines or allow other search engines to have access to properties like Google's web indexer or even their large language model. The future of search is really in artificial intelligence and the ability of chatbots to really revolutionize how people get information off the internet. And so I think that we're going to be really clued in to how this court crafts remedies that ensure that that next era of AI innovation is not being controlled by Google or any other dominant player in this market.
Well, and then finally, do you see knock-on effects? It does seem like a paradigm shift in terms of antitrust and the way we think about big companies. Do you see knock-on effects on not just tech companies, but other big businesses?
I do. And I think that when you have a case of this magnitude, there is going to be a bit of a culture shift. So if I'm a big law firm advising my clients, I'm going to tell them, hey, if you are entering into these types of exclusive agreements that are intended to maintain your market power, maybe you shouldn't do that anymore because the court is looking at these agreements with fresh eyes and they're not passing muster. I also think this decision builds momentum behind some of the other cases that the government has brought. There are parallels to the case against Live Nation, which also uses Ticketmaster to enter into exclusive agreements with venues. There are other parallels to the case against Apple or Amazon, which also kind of lock consumers into a single product ecosystem. So there's going to be knock-on effects outside of this case, outside of this industry, and also for other pending cases that we're watching closely.
All right, then we'll end on that note. We've been speaking with Lee Heppner, Senior Legal Counsel at the American Economic Liberties Project. They're online at economicliberties.us. Thank you so much, Lee Heppner, for joining us this week on Counterspin.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Years of negotiations led to the recently announced pretrial agreements for Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and two other defendants accused of directing the September 11, 2001 attacks on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon. That would have meant their pleading guilty to charges including murder and conspiracy and receiving lifelong prison sentences. As AP put it, quote, "The torture that the defendants underwent while in CIA custody has slowed
the cases and left the prospect of full trials and verdicts still uncertain, in part because of the inadmissibility of evidence linked to the torture. Close quote. But at the 11th hour, Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin stepped in to override the agreements, claiming to do so in the name of victims' families, the U.S. military, and the American public, who he says deserve the opportunity to see a military commission trial play out. Here to help us understand what happened and what happens now is Shaina Kadidal, Senior Managing Attorney at the Center for Constitutional Rights. Welcome to Counterspin, Shaina Kadidal.
Thanks for having me.
Media attention to Guantanamo Bay and what happens to those held there has been spotty and in recent years largely absent. So listeners may have forgotten that men were held there for years without charge, much less conviction. Some have been approved for transfer, meaning they've been determined not to be a threat, yet have remained there. And of course, it's undisputed that many have been tortured and abused at this extra-legal military prison. So these plea agreements came with all of that context, all of that history. And they weren't seen as a victory for anyone. Those aren't the terms to think in. But they were seen as a meaningful and overdue step, yes?
Yeah, I think any plea bargain is a compromise, right? As CNB is described as kind of the least worst solution, given the history of these cases, right? And basically, they've been presented as trading off the death penalty in exchange for guilty pleas. But I think the thing listeners need to really know is that prosecutors, the military prosecutors, really badly wanted this deal done, because I think, like everyone else who is observing these cases, they recognize that the death penalty was never, as a practical matter, going to happen in these cases for a bunch of different reasons, right? First of all, the military commission system is incredibly slow. They've taken the most significant criminal trial of the century, the 9/11 case, and put it into a system where everything is being invented from scratch. So things that have been well established for two centuries in the federal criminal system have to be kind of reasoned out from the beginning in the military commissions. And then on top of that, there are these kind of issues around the use of torture evidence that have really slowed things down. That's not to say that torture evidence is the main problem standing in the way of a conviction. There is plenty of evidence against these particular defendants that isn't contaminated by torture, including interviews they did with media before they were ever captured. But the bottom line is that this process is going along really slowly. The defendants are in their mid-50s, the two older ones already. And then there are a bunch of other questions. Even if they got a guilty verdict, then there would be a sentencing phase where a military jury gets to decide between death and probably life imprisonment. And we know that the CIA is very reluctant to produce its own officials as witnesses in that kind of phase of proceedings. They basically refused to do it in another case that we had involving a plea bargain. So that may end up being something that stands in the way of a death penalty verdict. Then on top of that, there's a worry that military juries will do what some civilian juries have done and react to the torture at Guantanamo with clemency, that they'll want to punish the government by issuing a life sentence instead of death. So bottom line, the prosecutors really wanted this deal badly.
Well, that might surprise some folks, I think, on the face of it. And then kind of on the other hand, some people might imagine that any kind of plea deal would be opposed by the families and friends of those killed, the nearly 3,000 people killed on September 11th. But that wasn't really the case, was it?
Yeah, it's a very mixed bag, I must say, the family members. You know, there are a small group of family members who are very heavily engaged in the details of these cases, including the politics of it. And they fall all over the spectrum, just like regular Americans. Got 9/11 families with peaceful tomorrows who have been out there saying that they were strongly in favor of this deal because it offered some semblance of finality, and because part of the deal, apparently, there's the ability to pose questions, I believe in writing, to the defendants and have them answered within 45 days. And those questions would go to not just things like the motivations for carrying out the attacks, but also some detailed things that we don't have a lot of information about, even from their interrogations, things like the financing of the attacks, right? So the families wanted answers to these questions, and this was really the only way they were going to be able to get it. You know, on the other side, you've got folks who have been on Fox News a lot talking about how the commissions are much tougher than the civilian criminal system, which really, I think at this point in history, you can say is definitively not true. but have been kind of very actively organized in favor of keeping these cases in the military system, right? It's, I suppose it's probably worth noting that if these cases had been brought to the civilian system, they probably would have been over a long, long time ago. It's unfortunate that Eric Holder had made the decision in 2009 to bring these cases to New York and try them in front of a civilian jury. If that had been the case, as he said last week, these guys would have been a memory. The cases would have gone to trial in a year or two. The appeals would have been over in a year or two, and they probably would have received pretty severe sentences, maybe even death. And the cases would have been over. As Holder said, it was, quote-unquote, political hacks who stopped the cases from being brought to New York, where they would have been disposed of much more quickly than in the commissions. But again, that's sort of political water under the bridge. Congress has banned bringing men to the United States for trial from Guantanamo. So again, this is kind of the least worst solution, plea bargain in the military trial system.
Well, when people hear that Defense Secretary Austin revoked the pretrial agreements because there ought to be trials, I think a lot of people might be misled about what is meant by a trial in this situation, a military commission trial. What should we know about that?
Well, the first thing is that it's going to take years to get there. These charges originally were brought in February 2008, and so it's been, what is that, 15, 16 years of pretrial motions. And they're nowhere close to being done with that. Then once you get to a trial, there are going to be all sorts of issues about, again, the CIA producing witnesses to what they did to these men, not just in the merits phase, but also in the sentencing phase, and then also where it took place. Like, we have a lot of sensitive diplomatic kind of concerns around where the secret prisons the CIA held these men in were located, right? So that may stand in the way of actually conducting a trial. And after that, you've got appeals into a military appeal system, and then from there into the appellate courts in the federal system, and then to the Supreme Court. So, again, the oldest of these defendants is 56 years old. They are de facto already serving life sentences if you think that these cases are never going to come to a resolution after a trial and appeals. And so, again, it made perfect sense for the prosecutors to pursue this. The real question is kind of, what was Lloyd Austin thinking? He had to have been aware that these negotiations were underway and were pretty close to being resolved. The New York Times even reported over the weekend that DOD officials knew about the progress of the negotiations. So why the reversal? I mean, I think there's no explanation other than politics in the election.
That's what I was going to ask, because Austin says he's long believed that military trials were the only way forward. So that rings a little weird given the timing.
Well, when you see people like Tom Cotton coming out and saying that this is Biden being soft on the terrorists with the plea bargain deal, you can understand why it might have been everybody's preferred timing on the political end for this to happen after November. You know, but what comes next? Look, first, there'll be legal challenges. There are very narrow circumstances where a signed pretrial agreement like this, a plea bargain agreement, can be withdrawn. So I think the defendants are first probably going to challenge whether or not what Austin tried to do in voiding the agreements was even effective, whether he has power to void them. And on top of that, military prosecutors are supposed to be relatively independent from people above them in the chain of command. In the federal civilian criminal system, everybody knows that President Trump can remove the attorney general if he doesn't like some prosecution that he's undertaking, right? But there are some norms about how the AG is supposed to be relatively independent in making judgment calls, right? Well, on the military system, those aren't norms. They're actually written into the two major statutes, the Military Commissions Act and the Uniform Code of Military Justice. So when you have a civilian official like Lloyd Austin, a political appointee, trying to pull the strings on a prosecutor's judgment, it's a serious problem. And dismissal of the case is the usual remedy for that. So again, something that could add years and years more delay to a system that wasn't exactly moving along quickly.
All right, then we'll end on that note. We've been speaking with Shaina Katidal, Senior Managing Attorney at the Center for Constitutional Rights. You can track their work on Guantanamo cases and others at ccrjustice.org. Shaina Katidal, thank you so much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thanks for having me.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is brought to you by the Media Watch Group Fair, based in New York. If you missed part of today's show or you'd like to hear previous shows, you can find years of shows and transcripts on our website, fair.org. The website is also the place to learn about Fair's newsletter Extra and to show support for the show if you are able and so inclined. The show is engineered by Riley Baer. I'm Janine Jackson. Thank you for listening to Counterspin. Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, few corporations have changed the U.S. business and consumer model more than Amazon. So when that corporate behemoth buys one of the country's national papers, it's a conflict.
Everyone has a community. A neighborhood, school, place of worship, or other chosen groups. Communities can provide support when you need it, including helping your kids avoid underage drinking and other substance use. Learn more at talktheyhearyou.samhsa.gov.
Did you know that Lyme disease is the most prevalent tick-borne illness, with about 220,000 new cases occurring each year? Believe it or not, you can test negative for Lyme and still be infected. Many victims of Lyme report never seeing a bullseye rash, and it can be very difficult to diagnose because it mimics other illnesses, such as multiple sclerosis, ALS, and Alzheimer's. To learn more, go to www.lymediseaseassociation.org.
Here's a special edition of In Black America and Ebony Spectrum for you. Happy holidays.
The police is coming down the street right now for somebody.
Oh, Lord. Not in my house.
Maybe Joe Biden is going to free some people.
Oh, Lord.
Let us pray.
You guys, I ordered a black tree.
I love it.
What is that a reflection of?
Being black, everything black. I might wear black all next year for the uniform instead of jean. I'm feeling real black right now.
We're broadcasting a very special Christmas segment and a couple of our favorite therapeutic mini pods from over the past year.
Is this space really safe? And that conversation, y'all got pretty heated.
Is it safer in the shallow or the deep?
I protect my peace. That is the mode I'm in.
It's probably why I don't make resolutions anymore.
You make pancake batter from scratch or is out the box?
Hell no, from the box.
Let's battle them.
So pull up a chair and join us. Native Land Pod is a production of iHeartRadio in partnership with Reason Choice Media.
Welcome, 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 welcome.
Hey, fam, we hope you had an amazing Christmas and also happy Kwanzaa and just happy holidays for whatever you're celebrating during this time of year. For this week's episode, we're going to do something a little different. We're broadcasting a very special holiday segment and a couple of our favorite mini pods from throughout the year that will help you get through these times that can be challenging for some of you for many reasons. Maybe you've lost somebody. Maybe you're going through a breakup. Maybe you have political strife and disagreement in your family. Maybe you have a beef with friends. Whatever you're going through, you are welcome home here. You have a seat at our table always. And so we just wanted to get into a little conversation and talk about how to manage those challenging times and take a look back at some of our favorite conversations from the year. So pull up a chair and join us. All right. So I'll be honest, for me, the holidays are definitely challenging, but for a lot of people, people is a very joyful time. So I don't want to act like it's all doom and gloom for everybody. This year maybe felt a little different for a lot of people. But Andrew, what about you? Are you have little ones, though. I feel like little ones always bring an element of joy to the holidays.
Yeah.
So what you
they
got?
Bring an element of something. A broke, a empty wallet.
Completely
you know,
empty. You hey, know, Davis.
They're home. Exactly. Except I'm calling all three of them by name. Likely the wrong ones. But anyway, the holidays absolutely shifted for me with, and I think Jay would reflect the same with kids, because it went from being about what I was going to get her and what she was going to get me and what we were getting our parents and siblings and whatnot to like, how do we make this very special for the kids? I mean, we've created our own set of traditions around it, right? Like the day after Thanksgiving, the kids are like on me, Daddy, the tree, the lights, and we spend all day doing that, and they are as much a part of it as I am. In fact, they're more a part of it, and they take great pride in that. So much of it for our household has shifted to be, the kids centerfold. But, I'd be lying if I didn't, also say that, I have real strong thoughts about my family members who aren't with us. My brother Eric, who passed away actually the year that my twins were born in an accident. My father, who passed away, a month and a half after my loss in the governor's race. And I have,